Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, our first headline reads, House passes mental health bill. Bill would unify splintered care systems for mental health and substance use, by Tom Barton. Iowa House lawmakers advanced a redesign Tuesday that would combine the state's delivery system for mental and behavioral health services, which advocates hope will improve access for patients. Earlier this year, Governor Kim Reynolds proposed streamlining and eliminating redundancies in Iowa's mental health addiction treatment programs. House File 2673 would merge Iowa's treatment networks for mental health and substance use issues into a unified behavioral health system. Currently, the networks are made up of 32 regions in the state, 13 for mental health care and 19 for substance use issues. The legislation would create 7 unified behavioral health districts, answering advocates' calls to treat the issues under combined funding streams. This bill brings to fruition the final piece, in my mind, of our behavioral health redesign that we started many, many years ago here in the State House, said Representative Joel Fry, Republican of Osceola, who led passage of the bill in the House. The bill passed 88-6, with 5 Democrats and 1 Republican opposed. It now heads to the Senate for consideration, where lawmakers are pursuing a similar bill. Some worry the proposal does not go far enough to address underlying issues that hinder access to treatment and services in the state, including low Medicaid reimbursement rates. Mental health and substance abuse advocates also have said they have more questions than answers over how services such as mental health access centers, like those in Linn and Johnson counties, would be affected by another shakeup of Iowa's behavioral health system. Numerous groups were registered undecided on the bill. The National Alliance on Mental Illness of Iowa, Iowa Mental Health Advocacy, and Coalition for Family and Children Services in Iowa were registered in support. The bill would contract with local administrative services organizations to carry out their services in each of the 7 behavioral health districts. The state would solicit proposals from existing agencies that oversee mental health regions or another public or private entity in the district to administer the 7 new regions. The bill specifies the new behavioral health districts be created on or before August 1st and organizations selected by December 31st to administer services. Those districts would handle prevention, education, early intervention, treatment, recovery, and crisis services related to both mental health and substance use disorders. Funding would be similar to block grants, Fry said. The goal of the new system would be to target funding to measurable outcomes rather than services. Each district would be overseen by an advisory board of local providers and government officials to identify opportunities, address challenges, and advise on the administrative services organization. Bill, Iowa couldn't sue pesticide makers over labeling, by Tom Barton and Aaron Murphy. As cancer rates in Iowa rise, state lawmakers continue to advance a bill that would add legal protections for pesticide manufacturers over the labeling that is required to warn consumers about the potential health risks associated with the use of their products. The proposal, Senate File 2412, would protect chemical manufacturers from lawsuits in the state over a failure to warn consumers about potential adverse health effects of their products if the products already meet federal labeling requirements. The protections would not apply to Chinese state-owned companies, singling out agriculture and chemical company Syngenta. The proposal is supported by Bayer, the manufacturer of the glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup that helped Republican lawmakers write an original bill draft. Bayer has been hit by lawsuits nationwide from individuals claiming it failed to warn consumers of the potential health risks of the weed killer. Bayer purchased Roundup maker Monsanto in 2018. The company has multiple crop science plants in Iowa, including one in Muscatine that manufactures Roundup. The glyphosate-based herbicide has received significant scrutiny over health claims and its link to the development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. About 165,000 cancer claims have been brought in the United States against Bayer over exposure to the weed killer, according to reporting by Reuters. Many were resolved as part of a $9.6 billion settlement in 2020, but about 54,000 remain. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found that glyphosate is unlikely to be a human carcinogen and that there are no risks of concern to human health when used in accordance with its current label. However, a U.S. appeals court ordered the agency to reconsider those findings in 2022. A World Health Organization cancer agency in 2015 found glyphosate, Roundup's active ingredient, was likely capable of causing cancer, but European Union regulators have determined there was not sufficient evidence for that finding. Under the Iowa bill, pesticide manufacturers would be considered to have provided proper warning about the dangers of their products if they used labeling approved by the EPA. The label is consistent with the most recent human health assessment performed under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or the label is consistent with the EPA's carcinogenicity classification for the pesticide. Iowa Senator Jeff Edler, a Republican and farmer from State Center, said the World Health Organization's 2015 report created what Edler called a legal loophole that allowed individuals to bring lawsuits against pesticide companies without scientific evidence that glyphosate causes cancer. Edler said during debate Tuesday in the Senate that the proposed legislation would close that loophole. "We're dealing with billions of dollars in lawsuits against the farm industry," Edler said. "The reality is that money is coming out of farmers' pockets. The price of Roundup and other chemicals has gone up exponentially because of these settlements." Edler also argued the legislation does not prevent individuals from suing pesticide manufacturers for illness suffered as a result of using their products. The bill, Edler said, prohibits lawsuits only over warning labels, provided the product already features a federally approved label. Senator Nate Bolton, a Democrat and lawyer from Des Moines, argued that suggesting lawsuits that would seek to prove negligence on the part of pesticide manufacturers without including the company's duty to warn consumers of potential risks is fantastical. Bolton and other Democrats argued the legislation ignores the safety of Iowa's farmers. But multiple major farm groups in Iowa, including the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, the Iowa Corn Growers Association, and Agribusiness Association of Iowa, support the bill, saying it would prevent unfounded lawsuits against Bayer, which they say creates a vital tool for farmers. The Iowa Environmental Council and other environmental advocacy groups oppose the bill, saying that despite the EPA findings, there are studies showing links between glyphosate products and increased rates of cancer. They say the bill would take away the ability of Iowans, including farmers, to seek compensation when a company fails to properly warn about the dangers. Also opposed to the bill are groups representing attorneys, according to state lobbying records. Iowa has the fastest growing rate of new cancers in the nation and the second highest cancer rate overall. Oncologists and public health researchers say it's time to look more closely at how Iowa's heavy use of ag chemicals, including herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, and nitrates, might be contributing. The proposal Tuesday passed the Senate on a 30-19 vote, with only Republicans voting in support and four Republicans joining all Democrats in voting against it. That makes the proposal eligible for consideration in the Iowa House, where a similar bill, House Study Bill 737, was pulled Tuesday from the list of bills to be considered by that chamber's Ways and Means Committee. Committee Chair Representative Bobby Kaufman, a Republican from Wilton, said the committee is working through questions and concerns some members have. "It's still a live round," Kaufman told reporters. Kaufman said the bill is needed because the EPA controls the labels of the pesticides and because there is disagreement on glyphosate's links to cancer. "The EPA requires the labels. The EPA will not allow them to give a warning for something with which there is currently no evidential link to cancer, and that is the crux of the bill," he said. "If the EPA were to allow them to put the labels they want on, this bill wouldn't be needed, and this conversation wouldn't be needed. But the EPA is telling them what will be on their label, and a warning for what is being claimed to have a link to cancer has zero scientific proof to back it up. Yet they're still getting sued for something they can't warn for. That's the conundrum we face." Sixth graders to join Iowa City Middle Schools this fall. Select sixth graders pilot BizTown, a work readiness and financial literacy program, by Grace King. Sixth graders in Iowa City began to develop work readiness, financial literacy, and entrepreneurial skills at Junior Achievement's BizTown, a learning experience that helps students connect what they learn in the classroom to the real world. Only a handful of sixth graders got to partake in the experience last week as part of a pilot program. But the curriculum will be expanded to all sixth graders in the Iowa City Community School District this fall as the grade level is moved out of elementary schools and into middle schools. BizTown is a real, authentic experience that will engage students' interests, just one example of many career and college exploration classes students will be exposed to in middle school, said Southeast Junior High Principal Michelle Cook. "Adding sixth graders to the junior high is long overdue," she said. "Being in an elementary school for 7 years, kindergarten through sixth grade, is way too long. I think they outgrow that system. They've been ready to be here. One of the battles we've fought as a junior high is not to be a blip on their radar," Cook said. The transition to middle school adds a third grade to the three junior high schools in the district. Educators say it will enable middle school students to find a passion and feel more connected to their school. The junior high model, which was just 7th and 8th graders, is too short a time to feel at home in a building. It also alleviates overcrowding, creating space for preschool to be offered at all elementary schools in the district. The move, approved by the Iowa City School Board in February 2022, requires about $34 million to expand the district's three junior highs to fit 300 to 400 6th graders at each building. The cost will be covered by already approved sales and property taxes. Lucas Tachek, Executive Director of Secondary Schools, said construction is ongoing and the district has a contingency plan of incorporating portable classrooms at the beginning of the school year if needed. The goal is that we don't have to use them, Tachek said. In middle school, students will learn time management, how to take notes in class, listen to a lecture, read academic texts, and study for tests. They're just so fun at this age, said Hannah Collins, a school counselor at Southeast Junior High. You're helping them build a lot of foundational skills and get them ready for high school. That's really special. Middle schoolers can be kind of sassy, but they're also really, really sweet, Collins said. Sometimes you realize all they needed was a listening ear and maybe a snack. Cook said one of the biggest concerns from families is that 6th graders will get lost or trampled in the hallways in a larger school building with kids who are older than them. But the middle schools will be set up so 6th graders' classrooms will be close together, and the 6th grade will have fewer transitions between classes than 7th and 8th graders do, Cook said. They also will have their own lunch period. It's also important 6th graders don't feel isolated and separate from the rest of the school, Cook said. They will be able to go out for intramural sports and be in after-school clubs that speak to their interests. School counselors and administrators from the junior highs are visiting every elementary, including introducing themselves to students, answering their questions, and helping them choose what classes they want to register for. Each 6th grader will take several 6-week exploratory classes, like BizTown, to help them discover what they're passionate about or what they're not. In 8th grade, they will create a 4-year plan to help guide them in planning out what classes they want to take in high school. These exploratory classes include agriculture, information technology, applied sciences, health sciences, and human services, to name a few. They're going to get a lot more career exposure, said Tim Sturgill, a school counselor at North Central Junior High. I think we do a good job of not pigeonholing a kid into something. We help them gain confidence in understanding their strengths and weaknesses, and that's okay. And that's okay if you change your mind about what you want to do after high school. Every year is important, but middle school is one of the most difficult, awkward, fun stages of life. I like helping kids figure out the pieces of the puzzle, Sturgill said. World War II soldier killed in action returns home for Anamosa funeral. Family receives closure as community pays respects, by Elijah Decius. Nearly 80 years after he was killed by German soldiers in France, an Iowa soldier has returned home to be honored for his sacrifice. Raymond U. Schlamp, who lived in Dubuque when he first enlisted in the U.S. Army, was killed in September 1944 after 3 years serving in Lieutenant General George Patton's Third Army. Schlamp, a private first class, died after being wounded on the banks of the Moselle River near Dornau under heavy fire. He was left behind while his unit retreated, and his remains were not located and identified immediately following the battle. Last year, DNA advances and new DNA samples from distant relatives helped the Army identify Schlamp's remains. On Saturday, his living relatives in the community will celebrate his life. The celebration of life with full military honors will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday at Lawrence Community Center in Anamosa. A private burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Dubuque, where his ashes will be interred in his mother's casket. Stories flowed every time we saw his picture. It was just part of our history. We never dreamed anything else would come, said Renee Menti, Schlamp's great niece. We just couldn't believe it. As Patton's 5th Infantry Division fought its way across France in the summer of 1944, American soldiers dug defensive positions at the edge of a tree grove known as Horseshoe Woods. The area represented the very forward edge of the U.S. advance, eliciting relentless counterattacks from the Germans. Schlamp was wounded in both legs by a sniper's machine gun fire as his company was retreating. Company aid men searched for him the following day but could not find a trace of him. The War Department declared him dead about a year later. In 1946, the American Graves Registration Command, a part of the Army Quartermaster Corps, was charged with recovering remains in the European theater. Grave registration operations after the war failed to identify Schlamp in the following years. Unidentified remains like his were set aside. Schlamp's remains were declared non-recoverable in 1951. When Schlamp went missing at the age of 29, the grief of his mother, Mabel Schlamp, was expressed through disbelief. Jean Reckemeyer, who is Raymond's niece and Mabel's granddaughter, remembers Mabel's endless letters to anyone who she thought could help locate Raymond. They wanted to find him so bad, she kept saying that maybe he had amnesia and didn't know where he is, said Reckemeyer, 93. It really woke me up to what war was about. With his return this week, Reckemeyer received a set of his dog tags. Even to relatives who didn't know Raymond, she said his final return to Iowa provides meaningful closure. A poem by Raymond's sisters about how he wasn't gone, just away for a while, will be read at Saturday's service. Reckemeyer said Raymond was quiet but always smiling and optimistic, with kind words to offer in any situation. He was very willing to go into the service. I think he was a true soldier, she said. I think this is going to be closure. The identification processed over the course of last year comes thanks to a DNA sample from Renee Menti, Schlamp's great niece, and a few other cousins. But when they got the call from the Army asking for their DNA, it almost didn't happen. When we hung up on the guy, we thought it was a farce, said Gina Smith, Menti's sister. Renee went through with it. After receiving some assurance of the official nature of the request, Menti, a science teacher in Fort Myers, Florida, said the family has been in awe of the process that has identified many soldiers from World War II well into the 21st century. We thought it was so cool that the Army, after all these years, still cared and actively searched out these soldiers, she said. I tell this story to almost everybody I get to know. Bill regulating THC in hemp products heads to Reynolds, by Caleb McCullough. Iowa's burgeoning hemp industry would be significantly regulated under a bill state lawmakers sent to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for signature Tuesday. The bill, House File 2605, would restrict the potency of hemp-derived THC products sold in Iowa and place regulations on the retailers that sell hemp products. Under the bill, products would be limited to less than 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 milligrams per package. Consumable hemp products were legalized in the 2018 Federal Farm Bill and later the Iowa Hemp Act. The laws allow for the sale of hemp products that contain less than 0.3% THC by weight. THC is the main chemical in marijuana that causes people to get high. The laws were intended to address sales of non-intoxicating compounds like CBD, but they also legalized the sale of hemp-derived THC products that have a similar psychoactive effect to traditional marijuana. Republican Senator Dan Dawson of Council Bluffs said the bill was desperately needed to regulate the consumable hemp industry. Republican supporters of the bill have said they did not intend to legalize intoxicating products when they passed the Iowa Hemp Act in 2019. In the last 4 years, we have seen the Iowa Hemp Act metastasize into some things we expected and some things we didn't expect, Dawson said. Now we are here today with a bill before us to try to put some desperately needed regulation on this industry. The bill passed the Senate 31-18. Three Republicans joined Democrats in voting no. The bill now heads to Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for a signature. If signed into law, the regulations would take effect July 1st. A spokesperson for Reynolds did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The changes would affect the growing number of retail shops and bars that sell hemp-based THC products. Iowa hemp retailers have expressed concern about the bill as it's moved through the lawmaking process, arguing that it would impose too many restrictions on the industry. Products containing THC sold at shops and bars generally range from 2.5 milligrams to 10 milligrams per serving, but some contain higher concentrations. Senate Democrats did not speak about the bill during debate Tuesday, but during House debate last month, Democrats said the bill would hurt the small businesses in the state that sell consumable hemp. Representative John Forbes, Democrat of Urbandale, a pharmacist, said it would not only affect intoxicating products, but also those sold for therapeutic purposes. Products that may contain 2 to 4 milligrams of THC per serving, Forbes said, will have to be sold in packages containing only a few capsules at a time. He said the suppliers of those products would not repackage them, making it difficult for retailers to find products that fit Iowa's law. It does have a major impact on, I think, the people here in the state of Iowa that sought out ways to manage their health issues, he said. A lot of the people that go to these do purchase them because they've been on chronic pain medications and they're trying to reduce. Reynolds' education pick gains approval, by Aaron Murphy. Governor Kim Reynolds' pick to lead the state education department, former Trump administration official Mackenzie Snow, was confirmed Tuesday by the Republican-majority Iowa Senate over Democrats' opposition, largely due to Snow's limited experience in public education. All 34 Senate Republicans voted to confirm Snow, which satisfied the two-thirds approval required to confirm her as director of the Iowa Department of Education. Snow has been serving in the post since June, when she was appointed by Reynolds to replace Chad Aldis, who served in the post for just 3 months before resigning for what the governor's office said were family reasons. All 15 Senate Democrats present Tuesday voted against the nomination, arguing Snow's dearth of experience in public education disqualifies her for the position. But with just 16 members in the chamber, Iowa Democrats no longer have enough members to force the Senate to reject a gubernatorial nomination. Democrats' votes Tuesday suggested two more nominees might have been endangered if Democrats still had the power to reject them. All 15 Senate Democrats present voted against Reynolds' nomination of Douglas Hoisington to the Iowa Board of Medicine. Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat of Des Moines, expressed frustration with the board's lack of response to Iowans' concerns in the past and said she had hoped Reynolds would appoint an obstetric physician given the possible changes to the state's abortion law. And nearly all Democrats present, 14 out of 15, voted against the reappointment of Catherine Lucas to the Iowa Public Employment Relations Board. Democrats have criticized Reynolds for failing to fill vacant positions on the board and for not adhering to a requirement the board be politically balanced. Two nominees, Kayla Lyon as director of the Department of Natural Resources and Jason Myers to the Board of Medicine, were on the Senate debate schedule but were not considered Tuesday. The Senate can consider their nominations on another date. House passes bill bolstering early literacy standards by Caleb McCullough. Seeking to improve the reading performance of Iowa's elementary school students, House lawmakers passed a bill Tuesday setting early literacy standards. The bill would add new instruction for prospective teachers in the state and introduce more targeted interventions for students who fall behind in reading proficiency. The bill, House File 2618, passed the House 92-3, with three Democrats voting no. A companion bill advanced in February out of a Senate subcommittee, but the chamber has not advanced it further. The bill was introduced this year by Governor Kim Reynolds as part of a push to improve literacy and reading instruction. Reynolds said during her Condition of the State address in January that although Iowa students' reading scores largely have held steady since the pandemic, the state should do more to improve those outcomes. About 34% of Iowa's third graders were not reading proficiently last year, according to the Iowa Department of Education. Children who can't read by third grade are four times more likely to drop out of high school, which dramatically increases their chances of being arrested, using illegal drugs, and having poor health, Reynolds said in January. The Department of Education also has offered a free training on the science of reading to elementary teachers, promoting the instructional approach that has gained popularity among state policymakers and educators. About 1,400 teachers participated in the first cohort for that training, the Department of Education said in March. If the bill is signed into law, Iowa school districts would need to give written notice to the parents or guardians of students who are reading below grade level in kindergarten through sixth grade. Parents would have the option to hold the student back a grade. The bill also would require school districts to create personalized reading plans for students who are not reading proficiently until they reach proficiency. Colleges and universities that offer teacher certifications would need to administer a reading instruction assessment based on the nationally recognized Foundations of Reading Assessment. The assessment would not be required for graduation or licensure, but the higher education institution would need to publish data on how many students received a passing score on the test. House lawmakers altered the bill from its original wording, which would have required prospective teachers to pass the Foundations of Reading test in order to graduate and receive a teaching license. CR man had knife ready as fight escalated. Teslick testifies that he thought racial slur would stop argument with Devona Walker, by Trish Mahaffey. Shane Teslick, who is on trial in Linn County District Court for fatally stabbing Devona Walker last year, testified Tuesday that he called Walker a racial epithet because he was just tired of all the conflict and wanted her to go away. Crazy enough, it worked before, Teslick testified without inflection in his voice. He remained soft-spoken and calm throughout his testimony. Teslick, a white man, admitted he called Walker, a black woman, the same slur in a previous argument on December 19, 2022, and it stopped the fight and made her leave. However, on January 2, 2023, Walker didn't leave. When Teslick told Walker he was going to kill her and called her the racial slur, Walker, who was on the sidewalk in front of his apartment, started running toward Teslick's girlfriend, Jesse Chavez, and at him, and he had a knife. Teslick will continue his testimony today. The prosecution rested its case after its final witness, a police investigator, testified. The defense may wrap up its case this afternoon. Teslyk is charged with voluntary manslaughter, a felony, and disorderly conduct, epithets, threatening gesture, a simple misdemeanor. He is claiming self-defense or defense of others. Teslyk, as his lawyer played video of the incident that has been shown throughout the trial, explained what happened that night as he repeatedly came to the doorway of his apartment at 2135 Northbound Court Northeast and told Chavez to stop arguing with Walker and come inside. At some point, as the arguing became more heated among himself, Chavez, and Walker, Teslyk said he retrieved a kitchen knife with an 8-inch blade and placed it next to the door on a shoe crate or shelving unit. Walker, in the video, ran toward Chavez, who had her back to Walker, and knocked her over. Then Walker went over Chavez and punched Teslyk. Teslyk said Walker punched Chavez in the head and Chavez wasn't moving. He told Walker to get the expletive back, as he was holding the knife and pushing her away, and she punched him 3 times, he thought. I needed to eliminate the threat, Teslyk said. I thought my family's life was in danger. Teslyk believed Walker was going to get past him and Chavez and go after Chavez's teenage daughter, who Teslyk said he regarded as his child, even though she isn't his biological daughter. He thought Chavez's daughter probably recorded the January 2nd incident because she had recorded the incident on December 19, 2022, when Teslyk and Chavez argued with Walker and Walker assaulted them. Teslyk believed Walker thought the same, that she was being recorded again in this incident. Teslyk admitted to stabbing Walker once. He said he didn't know where he stabbed her or how serious the wound was. In the video, Teslyk still was yelling at Walker as she stumbled back and then fell onto the grassy area of the yard. Teslyk said he realized she wasn't getting up and called 911. The knife penetrated Walker's left chest area, injuring her left lung and aorta, causing her to bleed to death, a state medical examiner testified earlier in the trial. Victoria Cole, one of Teslyk's lawyers, asked him if he had any ill will toward Walker. Like, I don't like her, he said. I was upset about the attack on my family on December 19th. Teslyk also testified that there were about 6 tenants who lived in Cambridge townhouses who were standing across the street, and they were staring at him during this incident. He said he felt panicked and had fear of what they might do. He said he thought they were part of a larger group that had gathered at another apartment earlier in the evening. Teslyk saw the group going in and out of the apartment, and he said it looked like they were invading the person's home. He recognized some tenants and saw Walker running from the group and going over to another tenant's apartment. He said Chavez called the police and reported it. State eyes deal in UI discrimination complaint. AG's office suggested $20,000 settlement to avoid further litigation. By Vanessa Miller. The University of Iowa has agreed to settle an Iowa Civil Rights Commission complaint of discrimination and retaliation from a former consultant for its Native Center for Behavioral Health, a UI College of Public Health-based enterprise supporting the Native American behavioral health workforce. Although Teresa Salt Brill sought $95,000 from the university to remedy what she characterized as significant lost wages and emotional distress, she signed a $20,000 settlement last Thursday and agreed not to pursue or accept any future UI employment. She also agreed not to sue the UI, which is not conceding any wrongdoing. The settlement, scheduled for consideration next month by Iowa's Board of Appeals, followed a November 3rd letter Salt Brill's attorney sent the UI, accusing it of cutting off employment opportunities after she reported sexual harassment on campus. Since Teresa's report and the adjudication, the University of Iowa has completely stopped giving her work, according to the letter, reporting the UI initially said Salt Brill was not qualified. But from January through September of 2022, the attorney reported, the UI assigned Salt Brill 49 projects. After that September and Salt Brill's harassment allegations, she received only 3 assignments. And after December 2022, all work ceased. The qualification requirements did not suddenly change, justifying the cessation of work for Teresa, the attorney wrote. Although UI officials originally suggested Salt Brill wasn't qualified, the letter suggested they later changed their reasoning. The university has now taken the position that her work was reduced because she was unprofessional, according to the letter. This drastic change in reasons is evidence of illegal motivations. Her attorney noted the irony of her client's experience, given the goal of the program she worked on was to help Native Americans deal with trauma and mental health issues. Teresa experienced trauma, according to the letter, and the program's response was to leave her out in the cold. Although UI disputes the allegations and contends its decisions were based on several non-discriminatory reasons, including the fact that funding for Ms. Salt Brill's work was about to terminate, the Iowa Attorney General's office suggested the settlement to avoid more litigation. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 3, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituary. Sandra Lee Ahomana, 71, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, March 28th at Living Center West. A celebration of life will be held on Friday, April 5th at Cedar Memorial Family Center and Library from 4 to 6 p.m. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Sandra was born February 13, 1953, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Robert and Norma Vic Matthews. Sandra was a daycare provider. She enjoyed family gatherings and watching the Iowa Hawkeye football and basketball. She enjoyed the many children she cared for and the many trips with them to the Dairy Queen and Splash Pad. She will be greatly missed by her family and friends. Memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society in memory of Sandra. Ronald F. Bloxham, 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, March 29th at his home. Graveside service will be held on Saturday, April 6th at 11 a.m. in Phelps Cemetery in Decorah. Tien Funeral Home is caring for Ronald and his family. Ronald Frank Bloxham was born May 27, 1934, son of Clarence Oscar and Delaney Mildred Rookharbor Bloxham. He proudly served in the United States Army. Ronald was united in marriage to Marilyn Gay Necker on September 11, 1955, in Waukon. He was a maintenance mechanic for many years until retirement. Ronald enjoyed watching NASCAR racing, collecting toys and refurbishing them, driving on Sundays with his fun car, a 1963 Riviera, and most of all loved spending time with family and friends. Memorials may be directed to the family for a charity of their choosing in his name. Online condolences can be left at tnfuneralhome.com. Josephine A. Bainey, 100, of Clarence, formerly of Oxford Junction, passed away on Sunday, March 31st at Clarence Senior Living. A visitation will be held Thursday, April 4th, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m., at Dawson Funeral Services in Oxford Junction. Her funeral mass will be held Friday, April 5th at 10:30 a.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Oxford Junction. Burial will be at Mayflower Cemetery. To view her full obituary, please visit dawsonfuneral.com. Jacqueline Hauser, 84, of Marion, passed away on March 25th. A private family graveside service will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in the Garden of the Cross. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. To express condolences, please visit cedarmemorial.com. Joseph Benzer, 96, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, March 30th. Services, 10 a.m. Thursday, April 4th at St. Jude Catholic Church by the Reverend Nick March. Burial, St. Joseph's Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Visitation, Wednesday, at Tien Funeral Home, where friends may visit with the family, from 5 to 7 p.m. and on Thursday at the church after 9 a.m. Joseph was born on March 18, 1928, son of Joseph and Florence Bowley Benzer, in Dubuque. He married the love of his life, Dorothy McGuire, on October 4, 1952, in Dubuque. He served in the Army for 2 years. He worked as an outside salesman for Sherwin-Williams Paint Company and retired at 62 after 35 years with Sherwin-Williams. Joseph was a charter member of St. Jude's Catholic Church. He and Dorothy spent many winters in the Hawaiian Islands. They loved playing tennis, jogging, biking, golfing, and just being together. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude's Church or Dennis and Donna Aldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Joseph's name. Online condolences can be left at tnfuneralhome.com. Catherine DeVore Reese of Manchester passed away on April 1st with her husband of over 65 years at her side. Kathy was born on the 31st of May, 1937, the daughter of Roy and Marie Nichols Welcherland of Manchester. She graduated from Manchester High School in 1955 and graduated from Presbyterian St. Luke's Nursing School in Chicago. While there, a young sailor, Gary Reese, stationed at the naval station in Great Lakes, met her on a blind date. As the saying goes, the rest is history. Kathy married that sailor on the 12th of October, 1958. They started a 65-year adventure that included living under various conditions in such places as the Philippines, Taiwan, Wales, and San Diego, as well as traveling around the world. Gary was an enlisted man when they married, and they were basically broke most of the next 5 years. After 4 years at the University of Missouri, Gary was commissioned an ensign in the Navy on the same day President Kennedy was killed. Gary was a submariner his entire naval career. Kathy was an active member of the PEO Sisterhood for over 65 years. She was baptized and married in the First Presbyterian Church in Manchester and was active in her church her entire life. She has been a vital member of the Manchester Planning and Zoning Committee for several years and volunteered at the local elementary school. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that memorials be directed to the Regional Medical Center or First Presbyterian Church. Online condolences may be sent to leonard-mullerfh.com. Funeral service 11 a.m. Friday, April 5th at First Presbyterian Church in Manchester with Reverend Nathan Lamb officiating. Visitation 3 to 6 p.m. Thursday, April 4th at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Private family interment, Oakland Cemetery in Manchester. Linda K. Wyatt, age 74, of Hiawatha, passed away Sunday, March 31st at Country House in Cedar Rapids. Linda was born August 16, 1949 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Jerry and Anna Marie Ursa Hasek. She graduated from Washington High School in 1967. On August 28, 1971, Linda married Roger Wyatt in Marion. She worked for Youth for Christ for 15 years and then worked at Transamerica from 2002 to 2014. Linda enjoyed gardening and sewing. She sewed blankets and dresses for an orphanage in Haiti. Linda loved spending time with her grandchildren, often spending time hiking, biking, and baking with them. Visitation for Linda will be held on Friday, April 5th from 10 to 11 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories in Cedar Rapids, with funeral service following at 11 a.m. with Pastor Richard Marchaud officiating. Burial will follow at Cedar Park Memorial Cemetery. The family will be giving any memorials given to Youth for Christ. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Larry C. Reeve, 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Monday, April 1st. Funeral service will be on Tuesday, April 9th, 4 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Visitation will take place 1 hour prior to the service, starting at 3 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel Stateroom. Full obituary to follow. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Evelyn Lucille Edeburn Engledow Mather of rural Vinton passed away peacefully on March 19th at her home just days following her 101st birthday. Evelyn was born March 15, 1923 to John Burl Edeburn and Helen Lunger, and later had stepmother Mabel Jellison Edeburn. S.H. Roy Mather and Ellen were joined in marriage on August 1, 1949 after Evelyn's first husband, Raymond Engledow, was killed in action while serving in World War II. Evelyn was an active member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and many of their volunteer programs. She loved knitting, crocheting, mushroom hunting, fishing, writing, and working in her flower bed. She cherished time spent with family and friends, often challenging them to a game of skip-bow. A celebration of life will be held Friday, April 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Christ Episcopal Church in Cedar Rapids. Please use the back main entrance. Corrine E. Betcher, 104, of Davenport, passed away on Saturday, March 30th at Clarence Senior Living in Clarence. Visitation will be on Thursday, April 4th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Wirtz Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held Friday, April 5th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Paul Lutheran Church. Private family burial will be at Davenport Memorial Park. Memorials in Corrine's name may be made to St. Paul Lutheran Church or to Camp Shalom. Corrine was born on February 27, 1920, in Mechanicsville to William and Edith Robinson. She graduated from Mechanicsville High School in 1937. Following high school, she attended AIC Business School. Corrine was united in marriage to Marvin Betcher on August 17, 1941. While Marvin was in the United States Army, she worked at Fort Lewis in Washington and earned several commendations for her work. When they moved back to Davenport, Corrine worked as the bookkeeper for Marvin's business, Marvin and Allen Hairdressers. Corrine was an active member of St. Paul Lutheran Church. She was a part of WELCA, the Quilters, and served on the Altar Guild for many decades, well into her 90s. She loved going for walks with her friends at the North Park Mall. Most of all, Corrine was a dedicated wife, mother, and grandmother. Online condolences may be left at wirtzfh.com. That concludes today's obituaries. Turning to the opinion page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Michael Fritz of Coralville. The headline reads, GOP puts tax cuts over public education. As long as we, the voters, allow the Republican mantra, tax cuts over social programs, there will be many unreasonable cuts to our public schools statewide. Somehow, my tax bill is more important than ensuring my community thrives in all socioeconomic strata. It is up to us to vote out the governor and most of her Republican colleagues for devastating public education, AEAs, public universities, and gifting money to private education. Iowa, historically, was a beacon of education excellence. That has continually declined with the Branstad-Reynolds regimes. A 2.5% budget increase, as passed, never meets the needs of Iowa schools. Business expenses, just because a school is open, go up at 4% a year. The gift to private education further drains public school money. We've allowed this governor and this legislature to fail our children, our most precious resource. The closing of Hills Elementary is deplorable in all rationalizations. Imagine draconian cuts to athletics, music, foreign language, to not moving forward with the middle school initiatives. We've allowed our most vulnerable to be shortchanged the education they deserve because they are young and many are immigrants. I will gladly pay my tax to be sure my community thrives. I admonish each voter to vote for what's best for kids and not some narrow, selfish mantra about cutting my taxes. That vote should never be tax cuts over social programs. And that's what we see with this governor and her Republican legislature. As a letter today in the Gazette from Michael Fritz of Coralville. Here's a guest column by Stacey Ray Johnson. It's titled, How Will Google Affect the Environment? The recent announcement of Google's decision to locate in Cedar Rapids has undoubtedly sparked excitement and anticipation throughout our community. However, amid the celebration, it is imperative we pause to consider the full scope of the implications, particularly when it comes to environmental and infrastructural concerns. While the economic benefits of Google's presence are evident, we must examine the potential environmental impacts. Questions arise regarding the utilization of natural resources such as water and energy. Will Google be drawing directly from our groundwater table or relying on potable water? What will be the repercussions for our city's water department and wastewater treatment facilities? Moreover, the energy demands of such a large-scale operation raise concerns about our existing infrastructure's capacity. Alliant Energy's recent request for a significant rate increase begs the question, how will Google affect rates? And what about the long-term consequences for our community's energy sustainability? These vital considerations seem to have been overlooked in the fervor surrounding Google's arrival. As residents of Cedar Rapids, it is our responsibility to demand transparency and accountability from both the corporation and local authorities. We cannot afford to wait until potential issues manifest themselves. Proactive planning and assessment are essential. Furthermore, the timeline for reaping the full benefits of this development raises additional concerns. Waiting 20 years for property tax revenues to materialize poses significant challenges, especially if unforeseen expenses arise in the interim. As responsible citizens, we must ensure that the short-term costs do not outweigh the long-term gains. In essence, while we welcome the prospect of economic growth and prosperity for Cedar Rapids, we must approach it with a critical eye. We cannot afford to ignore the hidden costs and potential consequences of Google's presence. It is incumbent upon us to seek answers to these pressing questions and hold both corporate and civic leaders accountable. Stacey Ray Johnson is a sustainability advocate who lives in Cedar Rapids. And we'll now go back to some news items I didn't have time for in the first half. Here's the first one. House Democrats target Miller Meeks over IVF. GOP Congresswoman says she supports the fertility treatment. By the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. U.S. House Democrats Campaign Committee has launched a billboard campaign targeting vulnerable Republicans in swing districts who supported a bill that could have threatened access to in vitro fertilization. The five-figure ad buy, which will run in static, digital, and mobile billboards throughout April, targets eight Republicans nationwide running in competitive districts, including U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, a Republican from Ottumwa. Miller Meeks co-sponsored the Life at Conception Act that states life begins at fertilization. Although the act includes language preventing the prosecution of any woman for the death of her unborn child, it does not spell out protections for fertility treatments. Miller Meeks supported the bill in the 2021-22 Congress, though she has not signed on as a co-sponsor to the current legislation. In a statement provided to the Gazette at the end of February, Miller Meeks said she supports IVF as a physician and mother. It is a beautiful pro-life act by families who want to bring children into the world. I also believe it should be covered by insurance, Miller Meeks said. What I find extreme and disingenuous is the Democrats' belief that abortion should be available up until the time of birth. She did not specify whether she supports allowing parents and providers to discard unused embryos. Miller Meeks signed on to a resolution that states that the House strongly supports the access to and use of IVF treatments and remains committed to common sense policies that enable families to grow, as well as recognizes the fundamental truth that life is precious. Critics, however, note the resolution does nothing to protect IVF, Resolutions are non-binding statements that express the collective sentiment of the House on a particular issue and primarily serve as tools for political posturing. We will not let Americans forget that extreme House Republicans, including those who pretend to be moderates, continue to put politics over families by championing out-of-touch legislation that chips away at freedom, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee spokeswoman Mallory Payne said in a statement. Christina Bohannon, an Iowa City Democrat and former state representative running to unseat Miller Meeks in Southeast Iowa's 1st Congressional District, is among politicians nationwide urging stronger protections for IVF. Bohannon, who has said she tried to have a child through in vitro fertilization, has called it disingenuous for Miller Meeks to say she supports IVF while supporting legislation that would make IVF impossible. Ash borer found in all Iowa counties but one. Only Emmett County has not had confirmation since 2010. By Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. Emmett County in far northern Iowa is the lone remaining county in the state with no confirmed presence of a beetle that kills ash trees, according to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. On Monday, the department said the emerald ash borer was discovered in Palo Alto County for the first time in a tree in a public area near Emmitsburg. The beetle was first found in 2010 in far northeast Iowa and has since spread. Now 98 of the state's 99 counties have confirmed cases. The beetle's larvae eat the living inner bark of ash trees and typically kill them within 2 to 4 years. The beetle's spread has led some cities to proactively remove ash trees in anticipation of their demise or to attempt insecticide treatments to prevent it. State conservation officials have estimated there were about 55 million ash trees in Iowa before the beetle's arrival. The adult beetles are metallic green and about a half inch long. Ash trees that are infested often have fewer leaves, sprouts with leaves coming from lower parts of the trunk or main branches, and holes where the beetles emerge that are shaped like the letter D and are about 1/8 of an inch wide. Governor signs off on Religious Freedom Bill by Tom Barton. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday signed into law a measure supporters say will strengthen protections for religious expressions in Iowa. Opponents contend it would give legal cover to discriminate against LGBTQ Iowans and others. Reynolds signed Senate File 2095 into law during an event closed to media hosted by the Christian conservative group The Family Leader. 30 years ago, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed almost unanimously at the federal level. Since then, religious rights have increasingly come under attack, Reynolds said in a statement. Today, Iowa enacts a law to protect these unalienable rights, just as 26 other states have done, upholding the ideals that are the very foundation of our country. Under the new law, state and local government shall not substantially burden someone's exercise of religion unless it is in furtherance of a compelling government interest and must be narrowly tailored in the least restrictive means of pursuing that interest. A person, corporation, church, foundation, or other entity whose exercise of religion has been burdened would have the power to go to court to seek damages, injunctive relief, or other legal recourse. The bill defines exercise of religion as action substantially motivated by one's sincerely held religious belief, whether or not the exercise is compulsory or central to a larger system of religious belief. Supporters say the bill is needed because, in their view, U.S. Supreme Court rulings have eroded religious freedom protections that were passed into federal law in 1993 by a Democratic majority Congress and signed by Democratic President Bill Clinton. The federal law applies only to the federal government, but at least 24 states have passed state-level versions of the legislation. House Democrats warned the bill would lead to state-sanctioned discrimination against LGBTQ Iowans and denial of reproductive health care, using religious freedom as a defense. Democrats introduced an amendment, defeated by Republicans, that would have inserted into the bill protections against discrimination as prescribed in the Iowa Civil Rights Act. The amendment aimed to restore the original purpose of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act while preventing its misuse to erode civil rights and sidestep non-discrimination laws. Others said the bill would undermine inclusivity and harm Iowa's economy, making it harder for Iowa businesses to recruit workers from out of state and retain residents. Several business groups and chambers of commerce were registered opposed to the bill, including Krauss Group, the Technology Association of Iowa, Principal Financial Group, and the Iowa Chamber Alliance. And here are some items from today's Capital Notebook feature. Iowa House passes tax credit to spur rural growth. Rural Iowa continues to see shrinking populations and Main Street businesses unable to keep the doors open. A bill unanimously passed by the Iowa House on Tuesday hopes to fix that. House File 2674 creates a new rural development tax credit designed to encourage investment in new or expanding businesses in Iowa's 88 smallest counties. It allows up to $27 million in tax credits for investors and makes $45 million in growth capital available, such as loans or equity investments, for rural small businesses across Iowa to expand their operations and create quality jobs. Eligible businesses must have fewer than 250 employees and must be outside of the 12 most populous counties in Iowa. The Iowa Economic Development Authority would begin accepting applications in January. The bill would create certified rural business growth funds for investment in qualified businesses. If all the money is not invested within 30 months, if the money does not stay invested for at least 5 years, or if enough jobs are not created, the fund managers would pay a penalty back to the state. Today, we have an opportunity to bring a truly unique solution to help save our rural communities, that we can make a statement that we as a legislative body are all in on the challenge, said bill manager Representative Derek Wolf, Republican of Hudson. We clearly know what comes first in this complex problem, and it's getting the quality jobs and businesses growing in rural Iowa. Representative J.D. Schulten, Democrat of Sioux City, said of the more than 3,000 counties across the country, only 28 of them receive 80% of venture capital money. So when we look at the future and where economic development is happening, it's not happening in well over 90% of this country, Schulten said in support of the bill. Democratic Representatives Ken Croken of Davenport and David Jacoby of Coralville expressed concern over the exclusion of the 12 most populous counties in the state, which still contain rural areas that would lose out on the opportunity. For instance, in Johnson County, we have the small town of Hills. Hills, Iowa, is losing their school, losing the backbone, Jacoby said. But now, under the Rural Tax Credit Program, they will not be eligible to participate to help rebuild their town. The bill now heads to the Iowa Senate for consideration. Senate OK's proposed amendment on taxes. Iowa voters would be asked as soon as 2026 whether to enshrine in the Iowa Constitution a requirement that the state have only one state income tax rate under a proposal approved by Senate Republicans. To amend the Iowa Constitution, a proposal must be approved by consecutive two-year meetings of the legislature separated by an election, then by a public vote in a general election. All Republicans voted for and all Democrats against Senate Joint Resolution 2004, which would amend the Iowa Constitution to declare that there may be only one state income tax rate above zero. Four states, Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, have a flat tax requirement in their constitution. State to pay after restricting reporter. The state will pay for attorney fees and adjust House press policies as part of a settlement with liberal journalist Laura Belind, state officials declared on Tuesday. The three-member state appeals board agreed Tuesday to settle a lawsuit brought by Belind against Iowa House Chief Clerk Megan Nelson after Belind was denied press credentials for the Iowa House of Representatives. Belind sued Nelson in January, alleging the refusal to provide her credentials to the Iowa House violated her First Amendment rights. Press credentials allow reporters to sit on the House floor and afford easier access to state lawmakers. Shortly after filing the lawsuit, Belind was given credentials to the House floor, and a policy requiring that credentialed journalists be nonpartisan was removed from the House press rules. As part of the settlement, the state will pay nearly $50,000 for Belind's attorney fees. Belind, the publisher and lead reporter for the liberal-leaning Iowa politics website Bleeding Heartland, was represented by the Institute for Free Speech. Nelson agreed to update the House press credentials terms to state that a denial of credentials will be accompanied by a notice detailing the criteria the applicant failed to meet, and to not reinstate the requirement that credentialed reporters be nonpartisan. The agreement also stipulated that Nelson admitted no fault over the lawsuit. Moody's, Fitch give Iowa top credit rating. Two major credit rating agencies reaffirmed a AAA rating for Iowa this month. Bond rating agencies Moody's and Fitch both reaffirmed Iowa's rating as AAA, signifying a high-quality credit rating and minimal risk. Moody's report said Iowa has a diversifying economy and governing practices that result in closely managed finances with healthy reserves, according to a news release from Governor Kim Reynolds' office. Despite the challenges of the national economy, Iowa's fiscal health is strong and stable, Reynolds said in a statement. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.